We'll move on to our next case, Kotz versus Wasafa. Ms. Dmitrieva.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please this Court. Plaintiff Peter Kotz brings this appeal to challenge the legal accuracy of the jury instructions that the district court used to instruct the jury at his trial. The trial involved Mr. Kotz's claim that the medical personnel at the Illinois Department of Corrections and the company that employed it were deliberately indifferent to his serious medical need by delaying for many months his hernia surgery and prolonging his pain and suffering. In particular, we challenge the legal accuracy of the legal elements instruction that the district court gave. The district court disregarded this court's patent jury instruction 712, which both parties agreed on, in favor of its own rendition of the law, which impermissibly increased plaintiff's burden of proof. Specifically, the district court instructed the jury that in addition to showing serious medical need and defendant's deliberate indifference to it, plaintiff had to show that defendants violated his right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment and that plaintiff had to show damages. Under this court's
Damage.
Right. The district court, the written jury instruction says damage. When the district court instructed the jury orally, the district court actually used the word damages in plural. But everybody understood during the jury instructions conference that when the district court used the word damage, it meant compensable damage. Because the specific argument the plaintiff's counsel used in objecting this instruction was that under the Seventh Circuit case law and under the case law, the showing of compensable damage is not necessary to show the liability under the Eighth Amendment. And the district court judge said, I disagree with that statement. So no matter, what the word damage or damages, everybody understood that the district court meant compensable damage, and this is just not an element of proving a liability under the Eighth Amendment. In the district court's inaccurate jury instructions, they were not inadvertent. As the district court's remarks to counsel show, the district judge sincerely believed that plaintiffs are required to show these two additional elements in proving their Section 1983 case. For instance, the district judge stated to the counsel that he wanted to zero in the jury on the fact that they have to find cruel and unusual punishment. And the judge apparently believed that in every trial, the jury has to determine whether defendant's conduct offends the current values of society. The district judge stated that, there is an element in cruel and unusual punishment about reflecting the current values of society.
Didn't the judge go on to define in the facts of this case, what that meant?
The elements instruction actually uses the term cruel and unusual punishment twice. In the beginning, it's like an intro to the elements instruction. The court stated that plaintiff has the burden of proving each of the following propositions to recover on his claim against the defendant regarding the violation of the plaintiff's Eighth Amendment right to be free to freedom from cruel and unusual punishment, considering each of the defendants separately. And then in explaining the second element, he stated, and in so acting, the defendant violated the plaintiff's rights to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. So the court
but then the court went on, I think this was what my brother was saying, the next line is specifically the plaintiff must prove, so the court breaks it down, that A, he had a serious medical need, and the defendant under consideration was deliberately indifferent to that.
The court does follow on saying specifically they have to find A and B, but the matter of fact, the court set it forth as a separate element, so there may be some confusion there to the jury. And early in the instructions to the jury, the court stated that cruel and unusual punishment includes denial of medical care that results in pain and suffering, which serves no valid penological purpose. I mean, the word includes doesn't mean it's the same as. The court never told to the jury that in order to find for the plaintiff, you know, they don't have to make a separate finding of cruel and unusual punishment. And it's undisputed, it's completely undisputed that it's not a separate element. And in fact, both parties objected, you know, to the court's instruction. You know, the defendant's counsel objected during the jury instruction conference. The basis is we do not believe it's necessary to either explain the statutory basis for the cause of action or its interaction to the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. I believe in that context this could confuse them. Therefore, I believe it's unnecessary. So we have both plaintiff's counsel and the defendant's counsel, whom I just quoted, saying, you know, this setting forth the specific element that you have to find that defendants violated the plaintiff's right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment could be confusing to the jury. And in fact, you know, this court's pattern jury instruction sets forth the elements of the course of action, you know, without mentioning cruel and unusual punishment. And, you know, there was really no reason for the district court to depart from this court's pattern jury instruction. And if the district court didn't depart, we wouldn't be here on this issue today. And the trouble with the district court's belief that juries have to find in every single case that there is a violation of the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment is that under district court's approach, in every single case, specific juries can apply their own standards. They could decide under their own standards what violates the current decency standards of society. But the fact is that the Supreme Court and this court have already determined that a deliberate indifference to a serious medical need is the same as cruel and unusual punishment. It does violate the current decency standards of society. So the juries are not free to make their own value determinations, you know, of societal decency standards in each particular case. And so the same as, you know, with the issue of damages. It was extremely prejudicial to plaintiff in this case because the court's elements instruction sets forth damage. You know, and everybody understood, the counsel, the judge understood he meant compensable damage by that word. You know, it was prejudicial because the plaintiff, he did receive the surgery after like 3 years. So the jury could have concluded that since he can't demonstrate compensable damage, he cannot establish liability. And that's just contrary to this court's law. The deprivation of the constitutional right is itself, you know, that itself constitutes harm. So you don't need to establish monetary expense or damage. And you don't even need to show actual physical injury in order to prevail on liability. So it was extremely prejudicial. Another error that we urge with the court's instructions is that the district court refused to instruct the jury that a policy that when medical personnel, you know, that the corporate defendant, Wexford, is liable for the medical personnel's acts only if the medical personnel acts pursuant to a policy. The district court refused to explain to the jury that the policy doesn't just constitute written policy, it also includes unwritten, unspoken custom. And, you know, I believe in this particular case it was very prejudicial because it's undisputed that if we believe defendant's testimony, Peter Katz was not seen by any doctor at all for 8 months, from May 2006 to January 2007, even after he was already scheduled for hernia surgery at the Johns Roger Hospital, even after he specifically notified correctional officers and medical personnel at the Stateville Correctional Center that he was scheduled for surgery. So they knew he was scheduled for surgery. He came back to the correctional centers multiple times complaining of his extreme pain. And for 8 months, he was never seen by a doctor. So obviously, no written policy would ever set it up in black letter law saying, you know, we're not going to do a hernia surgery for hernias that are reducible, no matter what the pain is, until the next fiscal year rolls around. So if the jury didn't realize that they could hold Wexford liable even under unspoken policy, that could have potentially prejudiced our client. And I would like to reserve some time.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dmitrieva. Mr. Charish?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michael Cherish, and I represent Dr. Alfonso David, Dr. Seth Asafo, and Wexford Health Sources in this case. After hearing 3 days of extensive testimony and evidence.
Instructions. I'm baffled. The instructions the parties agreed to are very clear. Mm-hmm. The point is not that a judge can't depart from pattern instructions. That's perfectly fine. But when the judge departs, usually it's to make them simpler. And here he made them more complicated because you look at the plaintiff has the burden of proving each of the following propositions. And first, you know, the defendant acted under one of the more of the ways claimed by the plaintiff. That's a strange thing. Second, that in so acting, the defendant violated the plaintiff's right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. So that's the second element. Then it says specifically the plaintiff, and I don't know what the jury is going to do with that. So they're told they have to find violated the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, and then the specifically. So are there two more things they have to find, or what? And I also think it's very bad to inject cruel and unusual punishment into a case about deliberate indifference, because a juror might say, well, you know, whatever happened here, this wasn't punishment. They weren't punishing the guy, right?
I agree, Your Honor. In general terms, I agree.
It's terribly confusing.
I've seen these instructions on several occasions as trial counsel. I've objected to them on several occasions as trial counsel. As was pointed out, I objected to them in this case. I preferred...
I mean, you're not the one that has the issue. Because then when you look at this, then this whole damage thing, and then not letting come in mental pain and suffering, none of that came in. I don't get it either.
Your Honor,
and it's not, as I said, you know, counsel on both sides tendered standard pattern instructions.
True.
And I haven't seen any reason why the court should have deviated. certainly deviated this way to, as Judge Posner says, make it more complicated.
I prefer the pattern instructions. Mm-hmm. That's why I tendered them.
Yeah, and that's why they were written.
Absolutely.
So there wouldn't be problems like this. So we wouldn't have a case like this.
The only question, though, is after the trial, did these adequately state the law, and was there the reasonable likelihood of confusion of the jury being misled?
It's the confusion. If I were a juror, I'd be very puzzled by this.
Your Honor, I think that what happens here is there is no additional element. Although I agree, 7.12 is preferable.
And you see, the second element is the right to be, and then specifically the plaintiff must prove. And then the puzzle would be, is that all the plaintiff must prove, or it's that they prove cruel and unusual punishment, and then they have to specifically prove this, is maybe that's part of it, right?
Your Honor, I believe what Judge Baker's instruction does is he defines cruel and unusual punishment as deliberate indifference. I don't believe it goes to the point of adding an additional element.
If he said that violated the plaintiff's right means, but he didn't say that. He said specifically must prove. That's not the same thing. It doesn't look like a definition of cruel and unusual punishment. It looks like something else, you know?
I think the way that it was done in context was he says cruel and unusual punishment, and he says specifically this is what you must prove. He then goes on later on in his own admonition to explain it a second time to make it clear, as he said, and he has to prove, first, the defendants acted in the way he claims, second, that in so acting he had a serious medical need and they were deliberately indifferent to that need, and he suffered damages, and his damages were caused by their conduct. It was explained a third time by plaintiff's counsel in closing argument, when plaintiff's counsel said, he will tell you, referring to Judge Baker, as my colleague Ms. Wehrman told you at the outset of this case, and as you have heard now in a number of times, that in order to prevail, Mr. Kotz must demonstrate that he had a serious medical need, and that the defendants were deliberately indifferent to that need, and that he was harmed as a result. That's word for word, 7.12, the pattern instruction.
The question is, the jury takes their instructions, which aren't very long, and looks at them, and it sees the cruel and unusual punishment. And it's true. They were told about these other things, But they also were told they had to find it was cruel and unusual punishment. The judge didn't say cruel and unusual punishment means this, right?
No, he did not use those words.
That's the big problem.
And he did, I believe, adequately preface it and adequately explain it by saying cruel and unusual punishment, specifically.
No, but that's vague. Specifically, what does that mean, specifically?
Calling your attention to an individual element with specificity, saying, in other words, I'm telling you,
see,
the problem is, you know, cruel and unusual punishment, if you don't specifically say what it means, it's really up to the jury's sort of imagination to imagine what that is. Those are really strong sort of buzzwords to a lay person. That's the problem. Those are buzzwords. Yeah. And so cruel and unusual seems it has to be horrible. You know, maybe he died. Maybe he, you know, I mean, the problem is he doesn't, at first it wasn't needed at all, period. Then if you're going to do it, at least say, and what that means in this case is that they have to prove this. You know what I mean? Then it would be very clear, and you'd at least you'd clarify the use of it, even though it was totally unnecessary to use the language.
I agree with the court's aversion to the use of those terms. I think, though, and the reason I have objected to these instructions in two different trials.
And have they been given in other trials as cruel and unusual?
Yes. These are Judge Baker's instructions.
Oh, these are his standard instructions.
These are his standard instructions.
So that was another question I was going to ask you, because I caught that you said you had objected before.
Yes, ma'am.
To this kind of, so he's given these instructions before. This is just his standard instructions in this type of case.
He gives them in every deliberate indifference
every
case.
Every deliberate indifference
over
case.
Over the objection of counsel.
I see. So this is just the first one to make it up here.
Yes, and the reason I object every time is that when you read them in their totality, when you read the whole packet, I believe they're slanted toward the plaintiff. I believe that what they do is they give a lecture, if you will, on constitutional law, on basically impressing on people how poorly things could be, and I think edging them in a non-slanted way toward a reward to the plaintiff, an award to the plaintiff. That is the reason I have objected in the past.
And now, see, I think it can be flipped the other way. You know, that it can also lead one toward a defense verdict just because of the use of the term. But the point is, you're saying that he uses these all the time, at least in your experience, in cases like this.
In every case I have tried in front of him, yes.
He uses this. Okay.
Yes.
How often do plaintiffs win?
That I can't say. I haven't looked at that statistically. I've tried two cases there. But I'd like to think it was the evidence. As I said, there were three days of evidence here, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's or your there skills, were, counsel. Your skill.
I wouldn't presume to make that statement, Judge. But there were three days of evidence here. They heard everyone. There is no question that Mr. Kotz had the ability. There's no error asserted here that he wasn't able to present a witness, that he wasn't able to make an argument, that somehow I said something at trial that was offensive or that slanted the verdict in my favor. What he wants to do is take Judge Baker's instruction and say that because he used the words cruel and unusual punishment in this one instruction, in this fashion, notwithstanding the fact that 7.12 was de facto given twice after that, once by Judge Baker, once by plaintiff's counsel in closing argument, that somehow did not adequately state the law.
But then we have more to come, because then we have the whole issue of damage versus harm, damage not being an element. Then we have, you know, he rejects the giving emotional and mental suffering as a component of damages, and then no definition of policy for the jury. I mean, perhaps on this one issue, perhaps that would be, you know, not error. But when we sort of look at the whole context, these other instructions, are these his standard instructions too?
Yes, they are, Judge.
So all the other ones that follow, so he always uses damage, not harm, and doesn't define policy. Okay.
That has been my experience.
Okay.
It was our position that damage and harm are indistinguishable, and that he did instruct on policy. He instructed on policy in the instruction that we've cited in the brief. I have it. and that is when he said a corporation can act only through its officers and employees. Any act or omission of an officer or employee of the scope of his employment and pursuant to the policies of the corporation is the act or omission of the corporation. Short Appendix 117. He clearly said it doesn't have to be a written policy. It can be any policy. If their people followed it and a constitutional deprivation resulted, they are liable. At trial, the only evidence adduced was a written policy of Wexford. That's all that was talked about. He instructed on the policy.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dmitrieva, how much time does she have? 1 minute?
I mean, the fact that the district court did instruct about policy without specifying what it is was particularly confusing in this case, precisely because the only evidence was referred to by, you know, witnesses and counsel as Wexford policy. It meant written policy. And the court refused to instruct that it doesn't have to be policy. It could be custom or rule. Other than that, do you want to have any more questions for me?
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Dmitrieva and Mr. Cherish.